Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. It's good to have John Cozy back. Today we're going to talk about democracy. Democracy. You know what democracy means. Well, Gandhi at one time, when asked, thought Western civilization was a good idea. Well, I think democracy is a good idea. Too bad we don't have any of it around America and around other Western countries. We sure talk a lot about it, but we sure don't practice it. And the countries that America, with their rogue Western allies, try to control, certainly, absolutely, don't tolerate democracy in any of them. John, as usual, I loved your article. Talk about democracy. Well, America really wasn't designed to be a democracy. Oh, I'll just quote, if I can remember, I think I pretty much remember the approximate exact quotes by, John Adams, America's second president. He said America should be run by the rich and well-born. Those were his words, the rich and well-born. And the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Jay, said America should be run by the people who own it. That's the kind of democracy Americans get. That's the kind of democracy the founders established. My goodness.
Well, you know, the real story there is that Adams and John Jay and other prominent people in the late 1700s really wanted to reproduce England in America. And you know, England is, in spite of what they say, England is a monarchy. It's an aristocratic society. I mean, they don't have lords and commoners for nothing. And the lords have always run that country, run it today, and will run it till the day they die. And John Adams and John Jay and Adams were simply Englishmen trying to reproduce England in America. And when the Revolution occurred, they wanted to reproduce it in a way that was exactly the same as England, except it didn't have a monarchy.
That's right, John. Right. Literally, same policy, change of management.
Yeah, that's all. That's all it was. And the hard taken steps we've made toward widening democracy in America have always been circumscribed and under attack. I mean the status quo ruling class does not want anybody to have a voice but them. And when somebody other than a member of the ruling class has a voice, they buy it off. I mean, it's as simple as that. And of course, they own the country, so they can buy it off.
Oh, indeed, they can do any darn thing they want. John, can I interject one thing, and then I'll let you go back to what you're doing? I mentioned it on most of the programs because so many guests come on who are part of the important project that I'm involved in and you're involved in, and I'm talking about the forthcoming Clarity Press book on Ukraine called Flashpoint in Ukraine, U.S. Drive for Global Hegemony Risks World War III. And John is another very important contributor to the book. He has an important chapter in it. And, John, I really loved it. I really did love it, and I told you when I read your chapter. And we're heading closer to moving toward publication. I'm hoping for sometime in May. There's a lot goes into publishing a book. Writing, of course, is the big part, but you've got a lot to do. You got editing. You've got all the steps, typesetting, printing, distribution, promotion. It's a big job, and we're getting near the end. Just a little bit more content to come in. I'm hoping I'll get it in the next couple of 3 days, and then we'll get everything wrapped up and get the process rolling toward publishing it. But again, John, my great thanks to you for your marvelous chapter.
Well, you're welcome. I don't know that it was that marvelous, but...
It pleased me. I think it'll please read it as well.
I try to write a chapter that was truthful and non-biased.
Well, it sure was, John, and it provided important information that nobody else. It's amazing. This was really one of the goals of the book. I think the goals of any book, especially if you have a number of contributors, to have each one contribute contact with minimal overlap from what the others contribute, and that's exactly what I've seen. Each chapter seems to be a standalone analysis. There's always a little bit of overlap. You can't help that. You're talking about the same subject, but each one focuses on a specific topic, and it's marvelous information. And John, I'll just tell you and my listeners that my editor at Clarity Press, who I work with on both of my books, my Wall Street book and my Banker Occupation book, she is terrific to work with, Diana Collier, and she's working on this one. She liked the idea. She's absolutely thrilled with the people who are contributing and with the content in the book, and both of us really feel this will be the definitive work on Ukraine when it comes out. There'll be nothing comparable to it. I really believe that.
Wow.
Oh, it's marvelous stuff, John. You'll see. You'll get at least one copy when the book comes out. So will I and the other contributors, and you can see for yourself.
I was laughing because I'm not sure the Ukraine will last that long.
Well, that's right. I honestly would like to have a follow-up book next year because one of the things I say is that the Ukraine story didn't end with the putschists in Kiev seizing power. It just began, and it continues, and I think the biggest part of the Ukraine story is still to come, and that'll be after this book is published.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, and as I said in my little piece, the Ukraine has been dismembered lots of times in the course of history, and that could very well happen again now.
Oh, it sure can. I don't want to in any way downplay the importance of this book, because the information in it really explains what led up to what happened, what's ongoing, what it means, what's likely to follow, this kind of information. And if you bought a second book, which for certain wouldn't come out until next year sometime, if there is a second book, you'd miss the whole explanation of what went on to give the second book meaning. So if there is a second book, and I really hope there will be, and I'll be very happy to serve as editor again and contributor, because it's such a major story, the gravest geopolitical crisis since World War II. It doesn't get any bigger than that. That's how important it is. And literally, there's a threat against a global peace. There's a threat for possible global war. I mean, this is major stuff, and we have to see the way things unfold, and they don't look good. I mean, things seem going from bad to worse, and of course America is manipulating everything. We want to get back on the democracy story, but I can guarantee, and you know it, John, the last thing America is going to allow in Ukraine is democracy.
Oh, well, I mean, it'll allow Ukraine the kind of democracy that we have.
The fake kind.
the fake kind of. You know, in many of my pieces, especially the ones about the Supreme Court, I've pointed out for a long time, I've been pointing out for a long time, that, you know, the Supreme Court in McCulloch versus Madison made this country an oligarchy completely. And you know, nobody's paid any attention to those articles, which I'm not surprised at, but now a couple of guys come out and do a, what they call an empirical study about influence of groups on government, and they conclude that America is an oligarchy, and I burst out laughing. You know, I mean, you can't prove anything about democracy by talking about influence. I mean, people don't understand proof theory in this country. Well, they don't understand anything in this country. But you can't argue one thing and conclude another. But America isn't a democracy. But that isn't what set me off. I mean, I've known that for decades. What set me off was that my observation, and of course these are only anecdotal observations, for which I don't have the means of gathering any proof for. I don't know anybody has, but. I'm dismayed by the amount of violence that goes on, not only worldly, but domestically. I mean, the amount of killing and maiming that takes place in this country every day is worse than Iraq. I read the other day, but again, this is kind of thing where you remember, but you have to take with a grain of salt because you don't know who gathered the numbers or where they came from. But I read a piece that said that every day in America there's an average of 44 people killed by gunshot. Well, I mean, that's horrific if it's true. I mean, I don't know if it's true or not, but I mean, a lot of them are killed, that's for sure, but whether or not they are 44 a day, I don't know. But
John, I've written about this. It's been a while, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I used FBI statistics showing these horrible numbers of killings, and I called America a gun culture, a culture of violence. And, I mean, if the FBI is admitting this stuff, I guess they get it from local police records. And, again, I don't have the article in front of me, so I don't have the numbers. But the numbers are horrendous, huge numbers, plus all the others who were shot and injured. And I think the numbers go into the tens of thousands, including killings and injuries by gun violence. And this stuff is completely ignored. Unless there's some, you know, if a black guy kills a white guy in downtown Chicago or downtown Dallas, John, you know, it can make headlines. But if a black guy kills another black guy, who cares? Nobody says a word about it.
Yeah, that's true. And anyhow, my observation of this violence set me to thinking, because you know I began to notice things that there was gun violence in the public schools, and people were up in arms about guns in private school in schools, and wanting security officers in schools and that sort of thing. Well, what'd the kids do? They went and bought knives. I mean, you know, this is a stupid society. They think that there's only one way to do something. And the violence continues. And that bothered me. But you know, I don't really know how to make a comparison between today and what happened in the so-called Wild Wild West. That was a very violent place, too. But how violent, I mean, I don't know. And I begin to wonder, is there something about democracy itself, or what we call democracy itself, that necessitates this violence, that causes it, brings it about? And I thought to myself, yeah, I think it is. You see, our democracy and all Western democracies in the world today are factionally based. That is, the political parties, whether they be 2 or 20 or, you know, something like near 100 in Italy, are all factionally based. These are based on beliefs people have about how the world should be run. You know, there's no justification for any of these beliefs, but people, they believe them. They have these idiologies, I guess they ought to be called. But you know, and when you have a democracy built on that, you necessarily produce conflict. What goes on in the House of Representatives in America goes on all throughout America. I look at Bundy and his group in where is it, Wyoming or Colorado or somewhere. You know, I mean, that conflict on the street is prevalent in America, and the reason for it is that we can't in this society manage conflict resolution. There's no way to do it. The courts can't do it because they're ideological on the one hand, and on the other hand, they're as slow as, well, as slower than glaciers. And nobody wants to go to court these days. You have a conflict with a neighbor, get your gun. You know, and you settle it in a few minutes. If you went to court, it would be years. By the time it came to trial, you wouldn't even remember what it was about. I mean, so this society is unable to resolve conflicts, and being unable to resolve conflicts, it's conflict-ridden. And that produces a level of violence in this society that I suspect, and notice that I don't know, but I suspect is greater than any society has endured in history. Now, the reason for that may simply be that human beings are naturally violent, and that the more human beings you have, the more violence you have, and I'm aware of that possibility, but I can't shake the suspicion that the form of government we have has something to do with it. I mean, you think of in just recent Supreme Court decisions, how they have managed to exacerbate conflict rather than resolve conflict. It's easy to come up with, 10 or 12 decisions that have done this. And it's part of the court's history by stare decisis. Let the decision stand means that a mistake in the court made 500 years ago, if we had lasted that long, would still be there today because they want to let the decision stand. The court wants to solve problems if it can on narrow grounds rather than on fundamental grounds. Consequently, the issues never get resolved. For instance, take the abortion debate. If the court had issued a definitive statement on that, instead of a narrow statement trying to, make it legal for some people here and illegal there and, okay during these months but not okay during these months and that sort of thing, this debate would have died a long time ago. But because the court left all these doors open for conflict to arise, the anti-abortionists over and over and over again try to find ways to sneak in between those gaps that the court left in its decision. It goes on and on and on and on, so that we have a situation where conflicts aren't resolved. They simply aren't. The penal system doesn't resolve them. I mean, you take a guy who grows up in a slum somewhere, on the streets or whatever, who gets into crime, goes into jail, is sentenced to a term, and he's just left to rot there or learn from other criminals till he gets out, and he's still, a slum kid, still a street boy. He's got no skills, no ability, no interest in learning, no nothing. He's left with the suit on his back and no way to support himself. So he becomes a criminal again, and bang, back in jail. I mean, we don't solve conflicts in this country. We encourage them. We manage to create them out of nothing, as President Obama did in Ukraine, created a conflict out of nothing.
John, I certainly agree with that, and the notion that not only the horrors that go on at home, but the fact that literally, and I say literally, America is permanently at war with enemies that it invents, because the last enemies America had were Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. They were the last enemies. America has had no enemies, none, zero, threatened America from August 1940, before August 1945, the official end of World War II. Germany surrendered in May. Japan wanted to surrender much earlier, but Truman and the generals wanted to play with their new toy, their atom bombs, so they gratuitously dropped two of them and murdered hundreds of thousands of Japanese, and I think the suffering to this day still goes on from the ancestors and the devastation of radiation that could be passed on genetically and so on. I mean, this is America's legacy, a legacy of permanent war. It's literally official U.S. policy, and then it just crosses over at home with the terrible violence and the terrible crimes, and the biggest crimes are committed not just by ordinary people. Somebody shoots somebody and commits a murder, even if it is a murder. That's minor stuff compared to the crimes of state at home and abroad.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that, this creation of violence that this culture is engaged in overflows. I mean, it overflows domestic boundaries. How do we solve any problems in international affairs? How does America solve any problems? We send troops, or you know, drones, or something of that sort. They talk about we need a diplomatic solution, you know, but they always send the guns first. But and they wonder, you know, well, why did that upset anybody? Why does putting troops, American troops, in Poland upset the Russians? You know, how would Americans react if the Russians had sent troops to Canada
indeed.
Or Mexico?
Indeed. Or if their ships patrol the Gulf of Mexico or America's east or west coast, the way American ships could patrol the Black Sea, and they do it provocatively, John. There's no reason for them to be there. They do it provocatively and stationing troops and incorporating former Russian republics and Warsaw Pact countries into NATO. I mean, America controls NATO, supplies 75% of its budget. Literally, NATO policy is U.S. policy, and other nations really have no choice to go along. It's a Three Musketeers organization, all for one, America. I mean, it's U.S. imperial policy.
Yeah, I'm working on a piece now that probably won't get any currency, but I'm trying to point out that NATO wasn't formed after the Second World War. There were NATO-like organizations much, much, much sooner in history, created by Western powers, and that these had a specific purpose, which was colonization. But that's another paper, so I'm not going to talk about that today.
I guess you could say World War I and World War II with the Allies versus the Axis. What do they call the Germans in World War I? Was the term Axis used? I don't think so.
I don't have any idea. Central Powers, I think.
Well, it's the same thing. I mean, you get a bunch of countries lining up on one side, you get others lining up on the other side, and we portray ourselves as the good guys and the other ones as the bad guys. Well, I'm sorry, bad guys are us.
Yeah, well, you know, I, again, people are talking about the Ukraine crisis having been started by Putin's annexing Crimea, okay?
Well, of course, that's nonsense.
You know, and I laugh at that, of course. That, you know, the demonstrations and the killings in Kiev didn't have anything to do with it, of course. But, you know, Americans can do that kind of thing. We can decide when something starts and have it our way. But It occurred to me that, you know, one event doesn't start a war. And I was thinking about the Second World War. The shooting of the Austro-Hungarian crown prince in Sarajevo, you know, didn't start the First World War. I mean, it had something to do with it, but it didn't start the First World War. What started the First World War was treaties between countries. I mean, the Austrians sent their army into to avenge the killing, and their army got slaughtered in an ambush in the mountains, and they had a mutual defense treaty with Germany. And they called upon Germany to get into the war. Well, trouble is England, France, Russia, and Italy had a mutual defense treaty against Germany. So when Germany got into the war, England, France, Italy, and Russia got into the war. And that was the cause of the war, not the shooting in Sarajevo. I mean, that shooting was incidental. I've written a piece about this somewhere way back in the archives in ancient history in my life about this, that treaties are sovereignty revoking instruments. You sign a treaty that if somebody in NATO is attacked, we're all attacked. So some punk in the Ukraine, you know, starts a demonstration, people get killed, and we have something going on that NATO wants to consider very much like an attack on NATO, and pretty soon the whole war is involved in a war, only because of the treaty, not because of anything that happened, but because of the treaty. And you know, that's the kind of thing that Americans are dumb about. We have NATO, we have CETO, God knows what else toe we have. We've got more toes than feet. So that's the kind of thing that's scary, that we have all these commitments we have made to all these countries that we're going to come to their defense, you know, if they stub their toes. Well, no, that's a dangerous situation. And for America to be doing it is extremely dangerous, because since the Second World War, we have not militarily vanquished anyone. Not anyone. In Korea, we were on the verge of beating the North Koreans, and our hubris enabled us to think that the Chinese would never get involved, and overnight the Chinese were involved, and we were running for our lives. I mean, I know we were running for our lives. I was there.
Hmm. I was lucky, you know. John, I missed it.
Well, I said I'm glad you missed it. But the point is that, you know, we didn't win that war militarily. As a matter of fact, we sued for peace, for a truce. Not even a peace. We don't have peace today. We sued for a truce because we were getting the pants beat off us. And, you know, then we were dumb enough to go into Vietnam after the French realized that they could not win that war and pulled out. We're going to win it for them. We're going to show those French, you know, who can fight and who can't. Yeah, well, you know what happened there. It didn't work out, did it? You know? And then, you know, we had some minor little Reagan Hollywood ventures that make it look like we won something we didn't. But we went into Iraq.
Grenada was won.
Yeah, but we went into Iraq, and that didn't work out for us. We didn't win that. Yeah, militarily, we beat the Iraqi army and killed Saddam Hussein. But Iraq's not a country now that values American influence, values American money, but not influence. We don't know what that's going to be like. And then Afghanistan's another one. 10 years, 11 years, can't win that war. You know, so here we are on the brink of trying to start another war after losing, you know, 50 years of wars. Well, I mean, that's idiotic. I mean, you know, we all know what Einstein said about stupidity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results, kind of insanity. Well, you know, it's an insane nation. It's an insane foreign policy. I didn't hear much of the news this morning, but I heard one commentator on CNN, I think, point out that Obama's in a pickle. The Israeli peace process is falling apart. Syria is being won. Syrian revolution is being won by Assad, and Putin isn't backing down in the Ukraine crisis. Why should they? They know history as well as we do, or they should. You know. But anyhow, you know, to get back to my paper. Now, my paper was that, you know, this is a culture that it's kind of government, a kind of what we call democracy, which I know for a long time as an oligarchy, of stupid people, very stupid people, who will persist on doing over and over and over again what they think will get them victory, and it gets them defeat after defeat after defeat, and they persist in anyhow. Killing is killing is killing. I mean, You know, that's no way to win friends in the world. You know, America doesn't have any enemies in terms of governments, but there's a distinction between governments and people. And America has a huge amount of enemies when it comes to people. And rightly so.
Well, it certainly is rightly so. John, I say America has a marvelous capacity for making more enemies than friends, and the only way it gets other nations to go along is by pressure, by bullying, by threats, and if everything fails, by going to war. That's a hell of a way to practice official policy, but that's the policy of America. We're coming into a break, John. We can jump into it now and take a very short break, and then we'll come back and pick it up, John. So if you have a thought, hold it, and we'll pick it up as soon as we come back.
Okay, okay.
Welcome back. On with John Cozy. John, it really is a deplorable situation. It really is horrible. And what bothers me the most is the overall dismissiveness of the U.S. public. People are so much caught up in their own daily lives, which I understand. You've got work, you've got family, you've got illness at times, you've got kids to raise. I understand that. But so much is going on. It's causing so much harm. And it seems to get worse over time. If you look back a few years, as bad as it was, I don't think it's as bad as it is today. And I think next year it'll be worse than now, and we'll get into a new presidency after January 2017. I think it's going to get worse than it is now still. And how far can this go? I mean, we may be at war. We may have a global war before that time comes. And the idea of a place like Ukraine being a flashpoint that could ignite an east-west confrontation, which, I mean, of course, America versus Russia, with China very much involved, because China is also being targeted by America. China and Russia are America's two main rivals, and America wants no rivals, and it literally goes to extremes to eliminate them, including the possibility of going to war. And all three countries are nuclear armed, and they have long-range delivery systems. They can lob these missiles with great accuracy probably anywhere on the planet. The idea of waging a war like this, John, there's only one word to describe it, and that's madness.
Yeah, it's madness, and the whole system is geared toward misinformation. I say in the paper that conventional wisdom is that a democracy is the best form of government. I point out that no kind of proof has ever been offered for that proposition. And that it has not always been so in history. History has not viewed democracy favorably. Democracy was perhaps thought of by many people as the worst kind of government rather than the best. And you can go all the way back to Plato, of course. Plato's Republic isn't democratic. And he knew what he was talking about, because he knew about Athenian democracy. But when the powers to be went to hoodwink the people, they tell them over and over and over again how good they have it when they really don't have it very good. But in spite of the fact that we have a plethora of educational institutions, very few people get educations. And the reason for that is that the educational institutions are just as much a part of the ruling class as the Congress is. And, you know, you can't really educate people in a society that is built upon prevarication, because you can't lie over and over and over again to smart people. And that's what we do, because we lie to them over and over and over again. And one of the lies has been that democracy is the best form of government, and we are a democracy. We are the best democracy. I mean, that's been told to people for decades. It's a lie, of course. But, you know, how do you convince them it's a lie when that's all they ever hear?
They hear it over and over again, John. In a recent article that I did, it was on Ukraine, and it showed that propaganda works. You know, you repeat the big lies over and over again, and people buy the stuff. And polls on how the U.S. public feels about Ukraine and what's going on, various questions, answers to various questions, it shows that the majority of people in America buy the propaganda. I mean, that's all they hear if they use the corporate media, TV mainly. Some use print, but TV mainly. They buy the propaganda, and they accept this stuff, and they simply don't realize that they're being fed a lot of rubbish.
Yeah, they don't realize it, of course, and of course the press is complicit in this. You know, we have three 24-hour news networks. One is supposed to be extreme right-wing, and one is supposed to be somewhat neutral, and one is supposed to be a left-wing, and you know, and they are in a sense, but not significantly. When there's nothing better to watch around here, we turn on MSNBC, and that at times have people say the right things, but not in the right way.
John, I get BBC and Al Jazeera America also. You watch their stuff. I check them out, and they check the main cable channels out just very briefly to see where they're going. I mean, it's enough to give anybody an upset stomach and a headache.
Yeah, but one of the things I've noticed is, one of the tricks is that nobody that I know has pointed out, you know, they'll have, get some congressman on, and they'll have, they'll put a conservative congressman on for every issue, of course, because that's balance. The conservative congressman will get on, he won't answer any questions that are asked, but he'll give off a spiel every time. Same spiel, different congressman. Same spiel, different congressman. Same spiel, different congressman. What happens, of course, is that the people watching hear that spiel over and over and over and over again, and nobody ever questions it. Consequently, they get, you know, it gets ingrained in their thinking that's what they heard, and that's what they hear over and over again. It must be true, and of course it's not true. And the press is complicit by having those people on uncritically. It would be different if they answered the questions that were asked, but they never do. And of course, it's not just the Republicans that do this. I was watching some woman who's running some federal agency. God, I wish I could remember her name now and what agency it was, but I can't. And the reason I can't is because they dismissed it all. But she was asked four different questions by the moderator of the show, and she didn't answer a single one directly. She answered by making a speech about something else. And you know, he sat there and he took it, and he didn't say anything. he didn't say, no, that's not the question I asked you, ma'am, you know, or anything like that. He just listened to her, let her talk, and then he asked her another question, and she did the same thing over again. And that is the kind of most despicable journalism, you know, I can think of. Somebody might just as well have had those, put those questions under on a tape recorder or something, and had push a button when he was going to ask it. I mean, because it had nothing to do with anything that she said. And that's a subtle kind of way of propagandizing the Americans that becomes obvious if you watch carefully. And given that foundation of lies upon which the country is built, the public doesn't have a chance. Doesn't have a chance at all. When you get Supreme Court justices and the president, all of which who graduated from Harvard Law, and they don't know anything but conservative principles. Somebody said something, who was it? I don't know. I was thinking about the president. Somebody was talking about something, and I said, damn it, say to him, quit being a Republican. You know, but nobody says that to him. Every policy that Obama has advocated has been a Republican policy. You know, and what are you going to do? He calls himself a Democrat. And nobody questions him about it. Nobody asks him anything. Nobody puts it to him, you know. Again, you know, the drone killings. He's an assassin. Nobody tells him that to his face. No, nobody has any guts in this society, in the media, or in most other places either. I mean, you know, somebody says, the misuse of language bothers me, and you know, I know how it misleads people into thinking, but they say, you know, we killed 15 insurgents, well, no, 15 suspected insurgents were killed in a drone strike in Yemen, and then, you know, certain number of civilians, like 7, 4, 4, 5. And I say, dummy, you know, suspected insurgents are civilians. I mean, it was, you know, 18 or 19 people killed, 15 of whom were suspected insurgents. But you don't go around killing suspected people suspected of crimes. If we did, we'd kill all the congressmen. They're all good. Suspected of corruption. But it's that kind of misuse of language that the press even utilizes. Instead of criticizing it, they utilize it. I have heard nobody in the press point out that a suspected person is innocent until proven guilty. No. But suspected Al-Qaeda guys in Yemen, well, they're not only guilty, they're sentenced to death. I mean, and that's absurd. But you know, the so-called educated people in America let the government get away with this kind of thing, and it's disheartening. There's no way. Absolutely no way whatsoever you can convince American people of what the truth is so long as our institutions permit this kind of prevarication. There's just no way of doing it.
That's right, John. It really is right. People literally have no idea. They have no information or knowledge about the U.S. prison system and the fact that there are thousands, I emphasize, are political prisoners languishing in it. They never should be there. And even the ones that committed what we call a crime, like, you know, possessing a small amount of an illicit drug, it's criminal to put these people behind bars. Drugs should, I think, I deplore legal drugs as well as illicit ones. I mean,
just think of what historians are going to say about this society when the so-called illicit drugs, well, the drugs that are now called illicit, become acceptable to society, and everybody is using them. Somebody says, "Well, my grandfather, went to jail for 20 years for having a puff on a pipe like this." You know, and that's absurd.
It's crazy, John. It's okay to drink or smoke yourself to death, but if you smoke a joint,
drinking or smoking yourself to death is one thing. Climbing a mountain, skiing in an avalanche. I mean, there are all sorts of ways human beings do things that kill them. We're not going to outlaw them all, but I don't know why not. I mean, I don't know why skiing on a dangerous slope or climbing a mountain that you may not be able to get up is okay, you know, and if you make it, wow, what a hero you are, but smoking a pot in a pipe isn't, you know, I don't know.
And doing it, say, in the privacy of your home or with friends.
Yeah.
I want nothing to do with the stuff myself. But if people want to abuse themselves that way, it's their body. The government doesn't own their body. I mean, that really is hallowed ground. We have a right to use or abuse our body any way we wish, and the government should have no control over our bodies. But they want control. They want control there, John. They want control of our minds. They want control of everything.
Yeah,
but of course,
society, governments I've been thinking about this. Governments are funny kinds of things. What they do is tell the world what kinds of things that can be done in that society that society approves of. And everything that society doesn't approve of is outlawed. And you get rid of the people who do them.
That's exactly
right. One
way
or another.
That's the whole basis of the U.S. prison system. You know, get rid of the people that you fear may cause you some kind of trouble. Maybe you'll cause them so much harm that they'll only take so much and no more, and then they'll rise up and they'll resist. So you try to get as many of these people behind bars. I mean, close to 2.5 million people in U.S. prison. I mean, it's more than China with four times the population of America. It's the biggest gulag in the world, plus a global network of torture prisons. That you never hear a word about in the major media. I've written about it. I've written several times about it. And Guantanamo is just the tip of the iceberg.
You know, because of the problem I have with my eyes, I've got to wear a cap out in the sunshine with a visor on it. And the only cap I have with the visor on it is a cap a former colleague of mine. And gave me, which is a Korea veteran cap. Okay, so I wear it. Why not? And people are stopping me all the time, thanking me for defending our freedoms. And somebody said that to me one day in a conversation, and I said, "Tell me, what can you do that a person in Switzerland can't?" And he was stopped dead in his tracks. He had no idea what to say. I said, we talk about our freedoms, but we never specify them. And if you don't specify what freedoms it is that you're protecting, or what ones you want, or what ones you think you have that somebody else doesn't, you need to say so.
Are you talking about the freedom to own a gun?
Yeah, the freedom to own anything, you know. I mean, and we do it all the time. A politician will get on television and he'll say, "Americans want so and so." And I said, "You goddamn fool. You don't know what Americans want. Some Americans may want it, but you don't know what Americans want." You know, same thing. The Tea Party wants so and so. The Tea Party is nothing. It's people. And don't tell me they all want the same thing. They say this, things like this, well, human rights violations, you know. America protects human rights around the world. What human rights? Nobody has ever told me what they are. I have never heard. It's that kind of thing. That kind of unspecific, generalized statement that appears to be saying something, but is absolutely meaningless. It's a prevalent kind of thing in society. It's not hard to pick that up if you're an acute listener. It's easy to hear when they're saying things that they can't possibly know. A congressman, somebody got on TV and said that Putin's intentions are so-and-so. Then how the hell do you know what Putin's intentions are? Are you a psychic? I mean, that's dumb kind of thing that we listen to all the time. I don't know, I don't especially think that Putin is a great humanitarian leader. Most politicians aren't, and I don't know enough about him to know that he isn't one like most politicians. But, to attribute things to him that you have no way of knowing is mere chicanery, and that's all it is. I don't know what he's up to in Ukraine. I know one thing. He wanted to protect his naval base in Sevastopol when he took the Crimea, and I don't blame him, especially with American warships in the Black Sea.
I would put it another way, John. I would say that he agreed to what the Crimeans voted for overwhelmingly, 96.77%, in a referendum independently monitored that was judged by the monitors, scrupulously open, free, and fair, without a single irregularity being found. So the Crimea, with 83% turnout, including the Tatars and the Ukrainians, besides the Russian nationals in Crimea, and it showed that by far the overwhelming sentiment for Crimea was to return to Russia, which they were part of Russia until Khrushchev changed things in 1954. So really, Putin and the Russian, I think it was the Russian Federation that voted on it, but really both houses of parliament of Russia, the Duma, the State Duma, lower house, and the Federation Council, upper house. I mean, unanimity, along with Putin, said, how can we turn these people down? They simply couldn't do it, and if I was the president of Russia, I wouldn't have turned them down either. I would have embraced them and accepted them, and the feeling and thing. Well, there's always a transition. It could be very tough. There are some rough spots, indeed. And of course, Ukraine and America is targeting Crimea. I put out a short article yesterday saying water was cut off. Well, they're doing something to rectify that. These are the kind of policies. But literally, the Crimeans will be so much better off under Russia than they ever were under Ukraine. And the UN Charter, very important point, guarantees the self-determination of peoples everywhere, and that's what Crimeans expressed, self-determination, and I believe that it should be supported. I certainly support it.
Well, yeah, but again, that's true enough, I suppose. But my point is that what we do in this country is lie to people, provoke people with propaganda that's made up of statements that we have no way of knowing are true. I don't care if anybody in the NSA has been listening to Putin's phone calls. You don't know what his intentions are.
We're not a fly on the wall in their policy meetings.
So you don't make statements about somebody's intentions that you don't know. You don't talk about human rights without specifying what human rights you're talking about. That sort of thing. It, Obama can talk about the right of the Ukrainian people to determine their own future in a fair democratic election whatsoever, you know, but he hasn't said anything about the governors in America who are trying to restrict American voting rights. I mean, how can you do that? How can you talk about fair and open elections in Ukraine when you don't even have them at home? I mean, you know, it's that kind of mental inconsistency, mental gibberish, I call it, that fills the minds of American people in the power structure. It's all a bunch of nonsense. Statements made that don't make any sense, that are then used to formulate policy that almost always goes awry. And when it goes awry, you know, we wonder what happened. Well, I'm telling you what happened.
Anybody paying attention?
Get wise to it, people. Listen to what people say and ask them, you know, abiding questions like, you mentioned human rights. What human rights? You know, you mentioned democracy. What democracy? Where? What are you talking about? But we never ask those questions.
John, we sure don't. We have about a minute left. If anything more you want to add, just to wrap up this discussion, it's important. Well, I think listeners to this program understand what's going on. I would hope that maybe they'll spread the message to others, because the stuff that we get through the major media, the megaphone or official government statements and policies, what's actually going on is polar opposite that, and everybody needs to understand it in our own, defending our own welfare.
Yeah, and you know, I'm just going to say one thing. You know, President Obama has on numerous occasions talked about education, talked about the need for more scientists and engineers. And I've often wondered if, you know, he thinks that science and engineering is so important, why didn't he become one? I mean, it's an important question. You know, you don't go to school to be a law professor if you think that science and engineering are what are needed to keep or to straighten our society out. You just don't do that. You go to school to become a scientist or an engineer.
Well, John, I would just add that a guy who became a constitutional law professor, it would be a good idea to practice the law that he preached. Well, of course, I wasn't in his classroom, so I don't know what he preached. But if he knew constitutional law, he understands it. It would be a good idea if he tried it sometime. But of course, he doesn't. John, I'm afraid we're out of time. I've got to wrap up. It was another great hour. I look forward to having you back last month, and I can listen to you in archives, and so can everybody else. But I look forward to getting you back next month, and I look forward to all your articles. They're really, for me, they're must reading, John, when they come, and I really appreciate you sending them to me.
Long live democracy, Stephen.
Oh, indeed so, John. Talk to you next month.
Bye-bye.
Join us. We're archived Thursdays and Fridays. Archives are on the Progressive Radio News Hour site on the PRN website. And Sunday's always live at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.